Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Here is the Prime Minister of Australia, the Right Honourable R.G. Menzies.
Fellow Australians, it is my melancholy duty to inform you officially that in consequence of a persistence by Germany in her invasion of Poland, Great Britain has declared war upon her, and that as a result, Australia is also at war.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the History Hit Warfare podcast. I'm really happy to say that I've been joined once again by Jim Burrows and his wife, Beryl. In fact, Beryl is a new addition to this episode, and you'll remember Jim from last Anzac Day. Jim is a 98-year-old veteran of the Second World War who fought in the Pacific campaign as a coast watcher. And for this episode, they've kindly come back on to warfare to talk about what it was like in Australia during the Second World War. What it was like for Beryl, who served in the Royal Australian Air Force as a records keeper, to live under the constant threat of Japanese invasion, of Japanese midget submarine attacks, of air attacks, and for Jim, posted all the way off the coast of Australia on the Pacific Islands, watching out for enemy invasion, and also just generally helping to spot the tactical movements of the Japanese fleet. In fact, Jim and the Coast Watchers are credited with really helping to secure victory at Guadalcanal. So this is a fascinating episode. Really great to have them both on the podcast. It's so rare you get to speak to people who actually served during the Second World War and hear the war in their own words. How are you doing today, Jim? How's the lockdown in Melbourne? Are you guys okay? Able to go out and about?
Nothing for 28 days clear, so we're all alive again.
Oh, that's brilliant. You offer us a glimpse of our post-COVID world. Well, thanks for coming on the Warfare Podcast. I'm really keen to learn more about Australia's role and experience during the Second World War. So perhaps we can start with that moment on the 3rd of September 1939, when Prime Minister Robert Gordon Menzies announced that Australia was at war. Do you remember this day, Jim? Do you remember what you were doing at that moment?
Yes, I do remember. I was only 16 at the time, and it was all pretty dreary news, but not unexpected. But then it was during the next 2 years where my twin brother, Tom, who'd joined the Air Force Cadets, and my elder brother, Robert, had been in the Fortress Engineers down in south of Victoria. While the Coast Watchers were fairly dormant for the next 2 years because the Pacific War hadn't started till December 1941. But in the meantime, I wanted to join the Army now, but my parents wouldn't sign the release because of the two brothers already involved. So I had to wait till I turned 18, and they couldn't do anything about it now, and I couldn't join the Army quick enough. It was all adventure at the time, and two brothers were up there. I couldn't get up there quick enough, but that's when I first joined. But in the meantime, the Australians had just generally got used to the war in Europe. They'd sent thousands and thousands of soldiers and what have you over there, and it was all quite on the Eastern Front until that momentous day when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, absolutely. So what did Australia do in those intervening years, those early couple of years, to start to prepare for the war? Because, you know, the US had a little bit of time since the war was declared in Europe to start preparing and mobilizing. Did Australia do the same? Did it start to up its war-making industry, get its troops ready? Was rationing brought in early on? What was it like?
Well, my memory's not the best during that period, but life just went on. I started work and the family had grown up after difficult times over the years. And I just turned 30, there was some rationing going on, but the main thrust was getting our soldiers over there to help the British over there in Europe.
Yeah, and thousands of Australians did go over to Europe and fight, didn't they? Absolutely. In fact, there was almost a million Australians, both men and women, who served in the Second World War. So perhaps you can give us a bit of a brief overview of what your role was, but I also know that your wife served as well. So what was her role as well?
Okay, well, as I say, when I turned 18 and I was able to join the army, it was the day we lined up to be given our uniforms and what have you that I learned then when they said, hands up those that have worked in an office. The rest of you are infantry. I had 6 weeks learning Morse code and I became a 2.5 year or perhaps 1.5 years with LAN headquarters. We're the only radio link with Port Moresby where the Japanese were just 26 miles away. And it was then when we'd moved up to Brisbane that we'd been released by the lovely ladies, AWAS, who'd come on stream. And they asked for 6 volunteers for radio operators for on secret dangerous missions. And that's when I could put my hand up quick enough. And I was one of 6 that joined the, we found this with the US Navy for 6 months running up and down in a PT boat. But getting back to 43, I think it was, my wife Beryl, who I didn't know then, of course, had joined the Royal Australian Air Force as a records. She was offered a job to learn radar with her sister, who had also joined at the same time. But Beryl, she lacked that, if you like, confidence in herself. So she knocked the radar back, which she later on sort of was sorry she'd done so. But so she was in records for 3 years. And who knows, she probably would have handled the fact that Tom, my twin brother, his records would have gone to her system. So that's roughly, if you like, the start of life with the Second World War with both Beryl and herself. Mm.
So Beryl's role then was being in the Australian Royal Air Force, being in charge and keeping hold of the records of those who were signing up and all the records that were going on in terms of missions, yeah, and so on and so forth.
Correct. And during that time, she was also involved in visiting all the poor airmen with terrible burns and injuries in the Heidelberg Hospital to help them get through their problems. So she had quite a different role in that area as well. Can I get Beryl to say hello for a minute?
Yeah, please do.
How are you?
Hi, Beryl. Nice to meet you. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Isn't she beautiful?
Jim.
Absolutely. You're a lucky man, Jim.
Jim's the talker. I'm the retiring one.
Yeah, Jim was saying about your wartime role and how you're in the records office for the Royal Australian Air Force.
Yes, I was in it for 3 years, yeah, and I loved it.
Wow, what did you do? What was your daily routine? What did you do?
Records, doing all the records of all the men and where they were and so forth. Only the airmen, yeah.
So you got a bit of a look of how the war was going on the other side then and where the troops were moving.
Oh, yes, I used to know what was going on and we weren't allowed to talk about it, of course.
You probably knew more than Jim.
Yes, yes, we knew what was going on, yes, yes.
And what was it like living back in Australia when you knew the Japanese were so near and off the coast?
Well, it was like all the young ones. Nothing was going to happen to you. You worried more about the people in London and what they were putting up with. We had rationing and everything. We were short of food, just like you, and comforts, and blackouts and everything. But otherwise, we had good times, all the ladies together. We were always with plenty of company, and that was always nice. It was rather hard when you left camp.
Yeah, lots of camaraderie, I'm sure, between the women in the office together.
Oh, yes, there was. And even today, if you meet someone that was in the services, you were straight away friends.
Yeah, friends for life.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Australia itself then, because you might think that during the Second World War, Australia was in a bit of a vulnerable position. Did you ever feel that Australia might fall, say after Hong Kong in 1941 or Singapore in 1942? Was there ever that feeling that Australia might be next as the seemingly unstoppable Japanese forces persevered and pushed on through?
Well, I hate that when you say that's a good question, but that's a good question because I more recently put a special article on my website on that very issue where the authorities in Japan were keen to, after their success of invasion of Rabaul and possibly going to be Port Moresby was found, but that's a different story. But they certainly hell-bent on invading Australia because they would have had their bases, including the Solomon Islands. But fortunately, Tojo himself and Yamamoto vetoed all that and said no, our resources would be stretched too far, and they couldn't have been more correct because that's what finished them on the Kokoda track when they literally just ran out of supplies. So Tojo himself and Yamamoto vetoed that order. So I've written in the article, did the Japanese intend to invade Australia? To which I've given the evidence that the answer is no. Whilst it was originally intended, Yamamoto and Tojo vetoed that. So the answer is no, they did not intend to invade. But in the meantime, they still continued to bomb our cities, knock off all the ships down the east coast, including a hospital ship, and also pursuing the attack into Port Moresby, which ultimately cost them 60,000 deaths. So that's of their own people, not to mention the poor Aussies and the Americans who also suffered. And for every death, there's 2.5 times more injuries, which put them all out of action. So it was a case of the Japanese killing their own people unnecessarily because they weren't going to invade Australia.
Can you tell us a bit more about the events of what happened at Port Moresby?
Well, the 5,000 Japanese on the flotilla that had walked into Rabaul and Kavieng, New Island, the Japanese then tried to, they landed and tried to take Milne Bay at the end of New Guinea and got the hell belted out of them and the Aussies make them retreat. But that all took place in February and March and April. Then they decided to go on to Moresby, and that's when the Coast Watchers spotted them, alerted the Americans' base, which was in Townsville, Australia. And then, fortunately, this is 3 or 4 months after most of the American fleet were battered and bashed, but repaired and what have you. So they had 7 of their warships on hand in the Townsville area and plus 2 Australian ships. So the 9 of them went out to the Coral Sea, which is the sea between Rabaul and Moresby, and the famous Battle of the Coral Sea took place. And it was one of those unique war events where neither sides saw each other visibly. It was all done by bombers and aircraft carriers. Both lost aircraft carriers and lots of bombers, etc. But the Japanese were beaten. They had to retreat back to Rabaul to be repaired and what have you. That's what saved Australia and Moresby in particular, to answer your question, because they would have just walked in and had all the infrastructure just like they did in Rabaul. So that was the history of Moresby. And then, of course, just in a few words, the young Aussies that only knew how to use a broomstick for their rifles went up the Kokoda Trail, and then later on helped by some returning diggers from the Middle East. And then, of course, the Americans, when they caused the Japanese to retreat. But they'd really had a... They got to within 26 miles of Moresby, but they'd run out of supplies and support.
Stretched themselves a bit too thin there, maybe. And maybe that's one of those decisions that kind of helps influence the fact that they don't move on to Australia. You know, you can't have that gap between your teeth of your military and the tail of your supplies, because you just lose all power at the front.
Yeah, correct. It's a shame. It's a shame. Just as an aside, I don't know how to put it, but Douglas MacArthur, who was totally in charge, and I'm not discrediting him in any way, because he was very instrumental in running the American machine to ultimately move up north. But he made the fatal mistake that he wanted to pursue the Japanese, who were in retreat and beaten in that Battle of the Beachheads, as it's called, with Gona and Buna. The Japanese lost something like 25,000 soldiers and all the wounded. But of course, unfortunately, the Aussies and the Allied Americans lost enormous numbers too. So once again, when the army was defeated, and no doubt about it, was heavily criticised by the Americans themselves, Douglas MacArthur made the wrong step there.
Absolutely. Can we focus a little bit on some of those attacks you mentioned on the Australian mainland itself? Because it was just 10 weeks after Pearl Harbor that same Japanese carrier force turned its attention to Darwin, with terrible and destructive consequences. They call it the Australian Pearl Harbor, don't they? Do you remember this? Well, I'm sure it's hard to forget. I'm sure it's etched in your memory. It's one of the worst, in fact, the heaviest attack and loss on Australian soil in military history, I think.
That was in February 42, and we certainly lost 273 killed at Darwin, and plus the injuries and all that. But they also bombed Broome and even went further east into Rockhampton, wreaking more havoc with about 69 bombing raids. Now, timing-wise, and how I saw it, that was February 42, and I joined, oddly enough, it was just a week before Japanese invaded Rabaul that I actually joined the army. So once I was in the army, I only would have heard whatever was in the local newspapers in Melbourne and so forth, and which was all pretty disastrous. But some of the bright sparks in government had deemed that the Japanese would invade Australia, and they called it the Brisbane Line, which means they'd given up that the Japanese would invade Rockhampton, the Townsville, Mackay, whatever, all of northern Australia into captivity, and with the last line of defence in Brisbane. Unreal. As it turned out, none of that happened, but that's how desperate, and in fact, even as far south as Victoria and other states, people were digging holes in their backyards to protect themselves and what have you, and rationing was on, and things were pretty tough. In fact, Australia was, with that Brisbane line declared, was pretty well under the understanding that the Japanese would be coming.
If you've always wanted to know more about some of the key events that shaped the medieval period and the modern world, then Gone Medieval from History Hit is the podcast for you. From this...
The king ordered all the Danish men who were in England to be killed because he'd heard a rumour that they were trying to topple him. They seemed to have been beheaded one by one in some kind of systematic manner.
to this.
The stakes are so high. Even when she first appears on the scene, Joan says, I've got 1 year to do this. So she knows that this is going to come to a sticky end.
With a whole lot of this in between.
The knightly class is a group of people who have been chosen by God. Armor is a physical proof that that's literally true.
With guests lined up at the drawbridge, it's time to let them in and begin the feast for your ears that is Gone Medieval, the podcast from History Hit. Together, my co-host Dr. Kat Jarman and I, Matt Lewis, we've gone medieval and we're waiting for you to join us.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Astonishing to think, isn't it, that if the Japanese had invaded, then they would have been able to push all the way through, and that the Australians had adopted a kind of defence in depth, which I suppose is the only way you could defend against such a vast preponderance of force coming through. If you look over into Europe and Hitler's attempts at trying to build a static defensive Atlantic wall, well, that just didn't work, did it? It was overcome in less than a day. So I suppose the only option that the Australians felt they had was to allow vast swathes of the country, because it is a massive country, to be held under Japanese rule for a short period of time, one would hope.
Yeah, well, you run the ball there, James, because all our army was over in Europe and we only had whoever was left. So it was really a case of the northern half of Australia would have been forsaken. But as it turned out, it didn't.
Yeah, well, fortunately. But they had you, Jim, as a coast watcher off the coast, protecting Australia and making sure that you could spot those fleets as they were coming in.
If I can put it in a nutshell, the prime, if you like, and the only mandate the coast watchers had, apart from the fact that don't get bloody well caught, because if you're caught, you won't be carrying out your duty, but was to report the movements of the Japanese in the practical sense, that is by air, the Japanese by air and sea. For example, all the flights down to Guadalcanal and Moresby from the Rebel base, and also the shipping that was knocked back on the Battle of Pearl Harbor. So that was the stage with the Coast Watchers not really protecting Australia. It might have been subliminally or in the background, but that might have been an ultimate effect. But getting back to your question, their role was quite simple, which they did very successfully, and as I mentioned in my main article, they turned the tide of the Pacific War when Halsey said the Coast Watchers saved Guadalcanal and Guadalcanal saved the Pacific War.
The objective is won. Southeastern New Guinea was an important enemy stronghold in the South Pacific. From here, they planned the invasion of Australia. Now their equipment, their bases, are in Allied hands. For General Douglas MacArthur, it is a victory of major importance. Australians and Americans hurled the enemy back into the sea.
You had a kind of regional tactical intelligence role, making sure that you could transfer back information to HQ to say where the Japanese were moving, what direction they were going, as a means to ready up any forces to intercept or to allow US and Australian forces to be ready for anything that was incoming?
Yeah, that really, in a nutshell, is the basic function we did. I know from previous discussion, James, there was a bit of a side issue there that were we worried or whatever, where we were overlooking Rabaul. Yeah, I've been asked, you know, were you scared? And say, not for 1 minute. It was all a big adventure. And I may have mentioned before, I've got the old adage that nothing's going to happen to you. It might happen to the other bloke, but not you. And it either happens or it doesn't happen. But again, back to your comment, I might have added a little bit extra there, but for the Coast Watchers, the function was not necessarily directly to protect Australia. It was to nominate the movements of the Japanese, which of course would have been steps to do that, but as I mentioned before, it wasn't going to happen anyway, but they didn't know that.
It is an astonishing history, and for our listeners who haven't had a chance to listen to Jim's other episode with us, Jim was a coast watcher during the Second World War, working with indigenous troops as well, locals who had been brought into the military, and Jim spent 10 weeks in occupied Japanese territory. Is that right, Jim? Was it 10 weeks?
10 months.
When you were reporting on Japanese movements?
So 10 months, not 10 weeks.
10 months. Goodness me.
Multiply them by four.
Bloody hell. What is it like spending 10 months in Japanese territory?
Well, we just had a routine. You mentioned the indigenes, which I'll start off with because they were so much an integral part of all the parties. I think I've mentioned before, and I'll just repeat quickly, that a coast watching typical party of 5 or 6 to 10 or 11, made up of three components. The first, the Aussie expats lived in New Guinea. As I say, mining operators, teachers, whatever, anyone that was there, they became the leaders of the Coast Watchers. The second was a radio operator, and I was one of those. And thirdly, most importantly, the indigenous natives. They were about equal in numbers, with roughly 400 coast watchers and roughly about the same, but they'd been specifically trained. And they were so essential, James. It was just unreal because, once again, without them who came on shore with us with their native skills, they'd chop down trees and get palm leaves and build a sort of a shack for us to have shelter. They would be used, because we were parked on a sharp ridge, they were used to act as sentinels, one at two at each end, in case any Japanese came along. And also they prepared us food, which was usually all rice. And most importantly, a little bit embarrassing to say, that they dug a hole and straddled it with branches so we could squat when necessary. They even rigged up some bamboo poles where you could use one end and watch it going down. Anyway, in other words, they were there teaching us how to live. Those indigenous were very poorly treated. I don't know what sort of money they got, but all I know is that we lined them up once a week and gave them a twister of tobacco that they used. Finally, the fourth element of the Coast Watchers, which came by default with 273 first independent commanders, had come up with Lark Force, and all the officers by and picked up by the Japanese and taken off in a nice safe boat to Japan, where they had a bit of a rough time. But every one of them made it home after 4 or 5 years or whatever it was. But in the meantime, it meant that all the troops of Lark Force, including the commanders, were bereft of so-called officers above them to look after them, give orders to them and what have you. So by default, they became lost soldiers, except for the 132 that were on the Montevideo Maru and drowned. They became, if you like, wandering ghosts, and Eric Feld picked them all up, and they became the fourth element of a typical party to provide military support. And in fact, most of them were involved in Bougainville and all the islands between Rabaul and Guadalcanal. And I think probably about 30 or 40 of them all got awarded medallions from the Americans. So they were very well looked after, but they did a did a wonderful job. So they were the four elements for which everyone, particularly the natives, were absolutely essential. And they were wonderful. We got to know them well, and obviously we soon learned Pidgin English. Like, time before me come long, place solely call him Rebel now. Man belong Japan, he come now, we kiss him and boot him right out, et cetera, et cetera. So I still remember my Pidgin English, and not to mention my Morse code, da-da-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-da-di-
say that without those indigenous forces who were treated notoriously badly, you probably wouldn't have survived during those 10 months.
For certain, if the Japanese had been doing their job, we wouldn't have survived. But it didn't worry us. We were there, given a job to do, and we did it, and that was it. And unfortunately, I was one of three brothers that came home.
Yeah. Well, speaking about back home, I was reading about the attacks on Australia, and one that I came across was the Japanese use of small midget submarines to attack Sydney Harbour. Do you know much about this case?
Well, we heard about it, I think that was in about July 42. So we would have known about that because I was still in Victoria before I'd gone north. And so it was all pretty nasty stuff, almost unbelievable. And in fact, we later learned, which I find it absolutely impossible, but way down as far south as Tasmania, a Japanese submarine, don't ask me how, came out with a seaplane put together, and the seaplane wandered all around Tasmania and into southern Victoria. It was sighted all over the place. Obviously, it was just reconnaissance, and there was no way of an attack or anything like that. They were just casing place out, but that's part of it. And in the meantime, the submarines were doing mortal damage, and including a hospital ship that went down with everybody, the Centaur, off the eastern seaboard.
Wow, it is amazing, isn't it, to recall this history and just think how so much of it has actually been neglected by those who write these histories. I mean, these are key events throughout Australians' history of the Second World War that I think we need to remember and to bring back to an audience. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Jim. Can I just ask, when was the war over for you? Because, of course, the Japanese officially unconditionally surrender on the 14th of August 1945. Is this the moment the war ends for you, or does it happen a little later?
The actual war finished there, and I had sent a message to headquarters, could we walk into Rabaul? And I just had the vague hope. I didn't know about Robert's fate, but I knew about Tom's fate. And we used to get sometimes some escapee natives out of Rabaul coming up through the mountains, and we'd patch them up with some medication, what have you, and I'd be probably careful that somehow or other in discussing and questioning the natives about prisoners, I was just sort of had a vague hopefulness that Bob or Tom might have been a prisoner in Rabaul. That wasn't the case. And the other thing is we weren't allowed to do that because with all the Japanese down there that mightn't have known the war was over, they might have wanted to knock us off. So in that case, the three of us and our natives, and without the natives, we wouldn't have known which way to go. We walked for a week down to Toll, where the 150 blokes had been massacred by the Japanese, but that was where we had another Coast Watcher base. And then from there, this is where my memory fails me. I don't know how the hell we got around. We didn't swim, so we somehow got down to Lae, where I was given the job of closing up the US base. Coast Watcher base, and then a few of us, I can't remember how we got around there into Fitch Haven, where hundreds if not thousands of Aussies were waiting for repatriation back by ship to Australia. And then some bloke said, what are you doing there? I said, oh, we're catching a plane back to back to Brisbane. I said, yeah, you'll be here for months, mate. And 11:15, the Liberator dropped in and picked us up, and we walk in the streets of Brisbane that afternoon, yeah. Mm. So they looked after us. All that had taken, getting back to your question, all that had taken from end of, that's August 15, to probably about late November or early December. Then I came down and I was discharged early. We had a point system when you can get out of the army, but because I had two brothers lost, got what was called a compassionate discharge, and I was allowed out in December. That's when I tried to visit my sister who died in childbirth, and then but I went straight back to work then, where I was with the Chartered Accountants Office. So that's 3 months after. Mm.
Well, I'm sure for many it was a time of celebration, but for your family, it must have been a time of mourning and trying to come to terms with that loss, but also, of course, very happy to have you home safe as well, I'm sure.
Yes, as I think I mentioned before, our family of seven became a family of three in just 4 years, with my father dying and sister in childbirth and my two brothers here, which was pretty tough on me old mum, but it brought us up during a depression with Dad always out of work and the sisters helping us, my sisters. So, but she lived till 83 and had a happy, the happiest time she had was in a retirement village at the end of her life. It was lovely.
And you're about to hit 98, isn't that right, Jim?
Yes, and Beryl's 97, so as of today, we're both 97, but I ran ahead of her then. Mm.
When did you and Beryl meet?
It was probably 3 or 4 years after the war we met playing tennis.
I can't play very well, but I love it.
That's where we met. Mm.
You met him at tennis, yes.
Beryl gets a bit embarrassed. I sometimes jokingly say she had a cute little bum with white shorts. And we got together and then actually she had a girlfriend and I had a boyfriend, a mate. And then this friend who became my best man was going out with Beryl, and I was stuck with the other one. But anyway, I'm the only one that had wheels, so I one night I dropped them all off and took Beryl home, and that's where it might have started. So it was 5 years after the war. In those days, most marriages took place in the early 20s, but we were both 27 before we got married. But we've now had 70 lovely years with the best wife you can imagine, and we're both doing all right at the moment.
Well, you're a lucky man, Jim. I'm glad that you're both able to continue to live up life post-lockdown in Melbourne and celebrate Jim's birthday.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, 96. He's an old man, isn't he?
No.
Married an old man.
98.
98,
that's right.
98. She's only 97. There you go. You're both very lucky. Keep enjoying the post-lockdown Melbourne life, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, James.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.